The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Merry Christmas, Savage Nation. And here is a gift for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation.
Yeah.
Here's the best from my month of February. The Savage Nation, Cleftones, Jamaica High School, circa 1950s. When the chrome was thick and there was much less hate.
I never set you free.
I went to that high school. I don't know if I knew any of the Clefts. I knew some of the Tones. I don't think I ever met any of the Clefts. I think one of the Tones was one of my friends. I love all these lectures on multiculturalism. I love the do-gooders in the government. They're telling us, oh, let's all get along. Like we never heard about it, you know. I need them to lecture me on who to get along with. I grew up in a melting pot. They're going to lecture me, all these elitists who, you know, guess who's coming to dinner. When was the last time they went to a multicultural affair that was real? I looked at my high school yearbook the other day. I actually, you don't know this, but did I name the magazine yet? I can't name it. In May, there's a major interview coming out with me in one of the biggest magazines that's going to shock America. Because it's such a anomaly for me to be featured in this magazine. It's like the opposite of me. But, you know, the New Yorker did a lot for that. The big story of the profile on me in May changed a lot of perceptions about Michael Savage. No matter what the left keeps making up about me, it's not sticking. My show is growing. My website has almost 2 million uniques a month. So something's going on. I mean, people don't listen to the left anymore. They've been found out to be frauds. They know that most of the money comes from suspicious foreign sources or George Soros, it is suspected, in order to defame anyone on the conservative side. We all know that. So the point is that I went to a multicultural high school. So I checked my yearbook the other day because he asked me what high school I went to or something. I looked it up. I said, there was a Korean kid who was my friend. I don't even remember a black kid who was my friend. Jewish kids, Italian kids, Irish kids. We were friends. I don't even remember it, really. I don't remember those days. I don't have that much of a recollection. I'm not one of these people who walk around with, oh, my high school. I don't go to the, what do they go to, these things? Reunions? I never went to one. The reason I never go to a high school reunion or a college reunion is not that I'm ashamed. I'm a successful man. I'm pretty prominent, frankly. I don't know anyone who went to my high school who did better than me. I mean, a lot of hard work. It took me a long time to get to the finish line. But frankly, I did, and I won the gold medal. But the fact of the matter is, I don't go to them. Why? What's going to be at a reunion? Everyone's going to be posturing. Oh, yeah, I own a chain of 13 yogurt shops in the... Wow, no kidding. Oh, yes, I have 32 franchises in Malaysia of massage parlors. Well, that suits you. I remember what you were like. I thought you wanted to be a gynecologist. Well, this was the next best thing. You know, that guy, I don't want to go to a thing like that. What's the good of it? Richard in New York on WOR. Go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
How you doing, Michael? Listen, you're worrying me a little bit. I want to see you back at Katz's Restaurant on
how. Wait, why am I? I'm worrying you good or I'm worrying you bad?
You're worrying. I'm afraid that you're going to get palpitations of the heart over here.
How did the big families in the 30s all live or survive without health care for every ache and pain? How was that possible, Richard?
Because if you didn't have it, I mean, you were...
Yeah, that's right. If the government gave it to you, you took it. You went like a crank to every doctor, three a day. You had an ear doctor, a nose doctor, a behind doctor, a foot doctor, a head doctor, an eye doctor, because the government pays for it. Because who is encouraging this? The AMA.
Yeah, well...
My mother used to say, Richard, I come from immigrant parents. My mother was a strong woman. So she once said to me, when I started complaining once, she said to me, she said, what do you think? I don't have aches and pain. She said, stop it already. You know, forget about it. Just don't even think about it. You know what? They go away. What's the big deal?
Well, they had children. They had children on the sixth floor walk up on Mulberry Street. They didn't go to hospitals at that point in time. But here's the point that I'm
right. They told them not to be a sissy if they got sick.
right. Well, they pointed.
you're laughing because they did. If a boy started to complain too much, and I'm sniffled, this and that, yeah, cut it out, will you? What are you, your sister? Go to school already. Just take a tissue.
Well, if you weren't there to play stickball or Ring Alivio, they poked fun at you. That was worse than anything.
Ring Alivio. Well, you really go back a long way. Do you remember, you're going to bring, I don't want to do the old man nostalgia hour here, but wait a minute, it's snowing in New York today. There's still snow on the ground? Did I tell this story? Do you remember this story, Richard, at all, the sleigh riding story on Bryan Avenue?
Vaguely.
Let me tell you the story because it's amazing to show you what kids can live through. There was a kid who had an uncle. The uncle was like 18. You know, in those days, people got married young or whatever. The uncle was 18. We must have been 8, 9. I don't know how old. So he's like, oh, let's go sleigh riding. So we get up on the sled on Bryant Avenue, and we live on Longfellow down below, a big street, cobblestone, heavy snow. And he's on the bottom, the uncle. Then my friend and I was on top of him, and we jump on the sled. We start going down the hill. The uncle loses control of the sled, and it goes underneath the wheel. I could to this day see the wheels. You remember those trucks in those days? Some of them were monstrous with chain drive.
Yeah, I remember that.
Monster, right. Chains on the a chain drive truck. We went under the truck's wheel and came out the other side. I never told my mother about it because she would have screamed and had a fit. Those are the things that we did. Big deal. We went to Hubert's Flea Circus. We survived. Went to Coney Island and saw the Wax Museum. We survived from the most horrible exhibits of murderers, mass murderers, monsters. Nobody had to give us balloons and candy when we came back or see a therapist. The reason we didn't go to a school therapist is A, there were none, and B, if we did, they were probably crazier than the craziest person on the block. Most of the school psychologists, are more sick than Metesky the Mad Bomber.
Oh, no, I agree. You know, you talk about the wax figures. It springs into mind that Nancy Lugosi, she looks pretty close to a wax figure. I remember those.
Do you think Madame Tussauds will actually put Nancy Pelosi in wax? She has to be. She's the first woman Speaker of the House.
No.
So she's already in. She's probably already in wax in London. Luckily, I'm banned in Britain. I don't have to look at it.
You talk about the chains on the old trucks. I remember.
I've got to ask you the most important question. There's only one thing I'm interested in. How old is the oldest person in your family ever lived? How old?
88.
That's not good enough. I expect an Italian at least. My mother went to 88. Were they healthy in the last 20 years, or that everything was wrong?
They were all basically healthy.
You said you're worried about my health. That's why I asked. I went to a doctor the other day, a cardiologist. He had checkups. He says to me, I want the next 20 years of your life to be high quality, or quality of life is more important than anything. I don't know what he meant by that. What do you mean? They don't want to give me medication for anything? I don't get that. What do you mean quality of life? I don't even know what quality of life means. I've suffered from the day I was born. What do you mean quality of life? I'm like Mother Teresa of the radio.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here's the best from my month of February. I'm going to start with something from nature, because to me it is rewarding. It's eternally rewarding. So let me give you an example. It's been raining out here on the West Coast for weeks and weeks and months and months. The weather looked like Seattle. Nothing to do with global warming. In fact, if you go to michaelsavage.com, you will see that the lead scientist, so-called, in the global warming hoax, has admitted he doesn't know where the data is that he produced, the hockey stick data, so to speak. It doesn't exist. He lost it. He couldn't find it. He made it up. He didn't make it up. He saw it. It came once in a fantasy, but he confused it with reality. Although he's a scientist, he thought he was Merlin the Magician. He had a point he had on with moons and stars on it. He took it off and put on a white cloak, went to Harvard, then East Anglia University, and presto, Al Gore picked it up and made a fortune. The next thing you know, every czar in the world had a deal going for a green this and a green that, and Nancy Pelosi's friends in San Francisco all had millions and millions of dollars worth of green contracts with Obama because the earth was falling, the polar bears were dying, the earth cap, the ice caps were melting, but it turns out it's all bullcrap. And so that's why I say to you, nature is eternally reassuring to me. So today was the first day of spring for me. Why do I say that? I know it's not the first day of spring. I know what the calendar says, but we got a hot day, 80 degrees out here in the San Francisco area. And I look at my yard. I'm finishing lunch before going to the station. I look in my backyard and I see the California jay. On the East Coast, they're known as bluebirds. Out here, they make a certain sound. They're very large, blue, bluebird-like birds. And they have a certain chirp to them that's very distinct, you know. And every time I see that bird or hear it, I look up because I remember when my kids were young, they loved that bird. So it brings back the whole, you know, childhood thing in the backyard, Oshkosh Bagosh clothing. Because you see, we actually were blue-collar in the sense that although I was an itinerant graduate student, I was, may as well have been a poor blue-collar guy in the sense that I had no job. Because I was unfortunately born a white male, and although I had a PhD with a 4.0 index from one of the great universities and written 17 books, they chose instead to hire unqualified women and minorities in order to make certain that the universities would melt down into what they have become. But that's your gain. I'm not complaining. They did me a favor. It was only 20 years of my life that was destroyed. So I see the jay in the backyard, and I see him pecking around looking for grubs. And I don't know what he was looking for in there. And he dug something up. It wasn't a worm. I looked carefully. I don't know what it was, but to him it was like a lobster thermidor. Or she jumped up on the fence and she was knocking down that lobster thermidor from the ground, happy. And I saw her looking around, you know, watching vigilantly. And I thought to myself, you know, contrary to the popular belief, it's not the early bird that gets the worm. It is the wise bird that gets the worm and doesn't get caught by the cat. And that reminds me of Obama. He is the training wheel president. He is actually the first training wheel president we have ever had. He is the man who can not only catch the worm. He can't catch the worm. He can't catch a break, primarily because the imposter has been exposed to most Americans. Everybody knows that the guy is faking it. Everybody except his czars. We've never seen as many czars since the czars of Russia fell. And here we have czars. The country has confirmed over and over again that the public knows that he's false. They know that he's not a mainstream centrist. They know he's a radical left winger, probably a Marxist of some variety. And whatever he does, they're on to him. And so, as I say, it's not the early bird that catches the worm. It's the wise bird. And this bird is not wise. When I was a little boy in the United States of America, the son of immigrants, my mother would proudly tell me that the difference between America and Europe at that time was that we had a giant middle class, a spectrum, of course, of people in the middle class from lower, middle, and upper middle class. But nevertheless, there was a gigantic middle class in America that distinguished this nation from Europe after World War II. I don't have to take you back into ancient history to know that at one time there were serfs and landowners, the princes and the serfs. That was all ended. Somewhere in the middle 1500s, I believe, when people were permitted to own their own land. And that was the end of the serfdom. That was a great step forward for humankind when people could own their own piece of land. So we have, through America, seen the growth of a tremendous middle class where most people own their own properties, their own houses, their own apartments, their own condos, whatever. That's a good thing. That's what makes us unique and great, different from any other society on earth. Until very recently, when something changed, a dramatic shift occurred in this bell curve, the rich, the middle, and the poor. The bell curve, looking at it as though it's strictly a bell, with a big middle, big fat middle, big bell, big fat middle bell, big fat middle on the bell, middle class, suddenly that shrunk. It shrunk. Honey, I shrunk the kids. And the big middle started to disappear. Diminish. Millions of people lost their jobs, lost their houses, lost their families. That's what is going on. That's going on in this country. That's where it's coming from. So now let me ask you something. Certainly Obama didn't start this. Bush did. But I called Bush a fiscal socialist, as I tell you, over 2 years ago. I was on to that fact that the Republicans were all part of the same conspiracy, albeit in a different track. I know about the Bilderbergs. I know about all of that stuff. But at the risk of your displeasure, those of you on the right, I'm not going to go into the Bilderbergs. I'm not going to go into the CFR. I'm fully aware of their interconnections to the banks on Wall Street and the governments that we have in the Senate and the Federal Reserve. Believe me, I could talk chapter and verse, but I choose not to at this time. I want to stick to the bell curve. So America was distinguished by the big, big middle. Are you bored yet? If you are, I can move on. We can talk about lingerie in Saudi Arabia. I mean, whatever you want to do, I'll go with you. I hear that they're banning lingerie in Saudi Arabia. Take a look at the women over there. You know why. I don't know. One of the women don't want lingerie in Saudi Arabia. Most of the men are in Paris picking. Okay, let's stop right there, but I don't want to get distracted. Okay, so the middle class starts to disappear, and there's actually a growth curve in the rich. There's a growth curve in the rich and a growth curve in the poor, and the middle class is shrinking. So we're becoming a two-class society. We're moving towards becoming a two-class society rather than a three-class society. You see what I'm getting at? And where did we last see the two-class society? Well, many places, but most typically in the Marxist socialist states, where there is clearly a two-class society. What you don't know is that these workers' paradises have a two-class society. You have the bureaucrats who work for the government, who live fairly well. They get the food. They have the dachas. They had the private houses out in the country. They had government cars and chauffeurs. And the other people lived on the, you know, fighting for the one salami hanging in the butcher shop that I keep talking about, because the agrarian revolution didn't work when it was run by the government. Now, of course, that's all changed. I recognize that. The Soviet Union is a hybrid in some ways. They have very little, in many ways, social freedoms are very diminished. But economically, they're in some ways more conservative, fiscally more conservative than we are. It's hard to believe, isn't it? But the Soviet Union is probably more fiscally conservative than the United States of America is right now. But it goes back to what I told you years ago in The Savage Nation. I was a big reader as a youngster, and one of the people I read everything he wrote was Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, you know about it. Huxley wrote in 1950 that in the future, he said, as the Soviet becomes more like, in 1950 he wrote that as America and the Soviet Union interact, the Soviet Union would become more like America, and America would become more like the Soviet Union. Enter stage left, Barack Obama. I want to thank my producer, Doug Lynn. I should have done this over the years. I don't do it.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
So the crisis that was created by George Bush's reckless fiscal policies, and we inherited, of course, was used to put in this inexperienced president that we now have. And now we wake up to find out that they're going to add insult to injury. Today we learn, this is all news, by the way, that the U.S. under this idiot Ben Bernanke has just said that we're willing to bail out European banks again by giving money to the European Stability Fund, the European Financial Stability Facility. In other words, we're going to send more money to them. There are a lot of people talking about that. I think the European Commission has talked about, said the U.S. official to CNBC, commenting on enlarging the $980 billion EU-IMF European Stability Fund. He says it is up to the Europeans. We will certainly support using the IMF in these circumstances. What you don't know is that the United States is the largest contributor to the IMF. The IMF, whose biggest single shareholder is the United States, has committed 250 billion euros to the EFSF. And it is not, listen to this, while reluctant to dictate to Europe how it should address the crisis, they're willing to give them money. What happened today after that announcement is that U.S. Treasury's prices fell, and the euro strengthened against the dollar today, after the news that the U.S. would be prepared to support an enlarged EFSF. Germany does not want to make the Stability Fund larger. Germany has a much more constrained fiscal policy. But the idiots who are running our economy do not understand the first thing about fiscal responsibility. These are fiscal anarchists. George Bush was a fiscal socialist, as I said for 2 years leading up to this election. I was the only one trying to awaken you. I have been the Paul Revere of radio from the day I started. I am the Paul Revere of radio right now. How these morons could be talking about George Bush, the reinvented George Bush, I'll never understand this. I don't understand how men who consider themselves to be so intelligent can be such schmucks and such shills. John in Binghamton, New York, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi. How can the golfer and
the wall banger look at themselves in the mirror. They're both assisting the cover-up because they both had hour-long on-air interviews with George Bush, and he was given like a glowing interview for a full hour on both of their shows.
Don't you look? Not don't you understand? I don't mean to denigrate you in any way. Don't you remember Rush Limbaugh, the great blowhard himself, Rush Limbaugh, when he was finally caught a few years ago for being a water boy for the Republicans, was forced to admit on his own show in his own words when he said, "I've been a water carrier for the Republicans, but I will no longer be so." Do you recall that particular confession of his?
I never heard that confession, but if someone would dig up the soundbite, I would.
Yeah, well, we'll try to find it. So he said that, and then of course the Bush bots and the Rush bots rushed back behind him and said, "You see, he's an independent." But now all of a sudden he's putting that behind himself, and he is doing it all over again. He has always been, in my opinion, a front man for the mainstream check-pants Republican establishment, which is how this talentless hack got where he is. And, of course, when you talk about the wall banger, he's just mini-me. He's the mini-me Rush Limbaugh. He'd be nothing if he didn't have Rush's lead-in. He's a nobody. The guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Do you know that he's only a high school, if that, graduate? Do you understand these guys? And I have to say it again. Many of you may take offense at this. But there's a certain point at which education does matter. There's a certain point at which being well-read does matter. There's a certain point at which being a scholar who has read thousands of scientific articles and has the ability to analyze data does matter. And just playing golf or hitting a drywall does not qualify you for being a talk show host. And I'm sick and tired of them getting away with it. But I think that this exposure may eventually bring us back to fiscal reality. George Bush did this to us. And there is absolutely no excuse for wall banger and golfer to be their Bush's public relations agent. None whatsoever. That's one man's opinion, John. Thanks for the call. I was talking about the banking crisis, the bailout of Europe. I warned you that when you start talking bankers, people immediately start, some of them, gossiping, the Jews did it and the Jews did this. Be very, very careful where you go with that. 70 years ago, it led to the deaths of millions from the same kind of drivel. And now we have another confounding variable mixed into the match of anti-Semitism, which is the disease of radical Islam. And now mixed in with that component is the pacifism of the West and the fact that we have no leadership running from Paris to Washington. We have nothing but functionaries and stooges and puppets. There's virtually not a man amongst them willing to stand up to this scourge that threatens to take us down. So be very careful before you start blaming the Jews for the banking crisis. That's why I brought it up. But there's another reason, and perhaps the most important reason, that my mind jumped to this book, Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, by Timothy Snyder, the brilliant historian at Yale. And that is because of Obama. Now, I know you're going to say, what does he have to do with Hitler and Stalin? And I want you to listen to me. I am convinced that Obama himself is a rather nice person, as was Pol Pot of Cambodia. Cambodia, under Pol Pot was a nice professor who went to Paris, studied Marxism, came back and introduced a transformational group of policies in Cambodia that resulted in the death of 3 million fellow Cambodians. If you remember the movie from the 70s with a mountain of skulls, they unleashed teenagers in red scarves, known as the Red Brigades or the Khmer Rouge in that case, who went about rounding up the entire middle class. Anyone with eyeglasses was slave labored or killed. Any policeman, teacher, doctor, lawyer, architect. In other words, anyone with a pair of glasses, anyone with an education, was considered a counter-revolutionary in Cambodia and killed. Now, we're not saying that Obama wants to kill the middle class in America. Don't be absurd. But when you see a man as intellectually feeble as Barack Obama, who keeps using the word transformative or transformational, you have to understand that both Hitler and Stalin believed in a transformative utopia that they were trying to create. And in this transformative utopia that they were dreaming of, they had to find a group to be blamed when its realization proved impossible. And in their cases, Hitler and Stalin, mass murder was then used and proclaimed as a kind of victory over that particular class. Now, those of you who have the simplistic schoolbook idea that the Hitlerites were the mass murderers and the Soviets, the communists, were the liberators, I have a lot of news for you. You don't know the first thing about history. You know nothing about history. You have to understand that the 3.3 million killed in the Soviet Ukraine were killed not by Hitler, but by Stalin. And the Ukrainians who died in the famine of 1933 that followed Stalin's destructive collectivization of the farms. The farms. Now, Obama has not collectivized the United States farms for better production, yet. But he has taken over General Motors. He has nationalized the healthcare system. Do you think it's beyond this man to nationalize agriculture in the United States of America? I'm going to devote a little time now to a very, very important book by Sinclair Lewis called It Can't Happen Here. This book was written during the last Depression. In fact, just before the last Depression is when it came out, or during the middle of it, and copyrighted 1935. I wouldn't waste your time, but I'm not going to waste your time, because you must hear what Sinclair Lewis wrote. Now, I want to remind you, Sinclair Lewis was a socialist. He projected a future America where a right-wing government would take over the country. You hear? Where a right-wing government would take over the country. And he, in his fiction, It Can't Happen Here, Sinclair Lewis wrote, the 15 points of victory for the forgotten men written by the Democrat candidate for the United States President, Buzz Windrip. And I'm going to summarize some of these 15 points. During the very first week of his campaign, Senator Windrip clarified his philosophy by issuing his distinguished proclamation, The 15 Points of Victory for the Forgotten Men. Now, I want to remind you, this is a fiction written in 1935 about what would happen to America if a right-winger took over the country. One, all finances in the country, including banking, insurance, stocks and bonds, and mortgages, shall be under the absolute control of a federal central bank, owned by the government, and conducted by a board appointed by the president, which board shall, without need of recourse to Congress for legislative authorization, be empowered to make all regulations governing finance. Two, the president shall appoint a commission equally divided between manual workers, employers, and representatives of the public to determine which labor unions are qualified to represent the workers. Number three, after the revolution, in contradistinction to the doctrines of red radicals, now remember, this was a projection of what would happen should a right-winger take over the government. In contradistinction to the doctrines of red radicals with their felonious expropriation of the arduously acquired possessions which ensure to aged persons their security, this league and party will guarantee private initiative and the right to private property for all time. Four, believing that only under God Almighty, to whom we render all homage, do we Americans hold our vast power, we shall guarantee to all persons absolute freedom of religious worship, provided, however, that no atheist, agnostic, believer in black magic, nor any Jew who shall refuse to swear allegiance to the New Testament, nor any person of any faith who refuses to take the pledge to the flag, shall be permitted to hold any public office or to practice as a teacher, professor, lawyer, judge, or as a physician, except in the category of obstetrics. Five, annual net income per person shall be limited to $500,000. No accumulated fortune may at any one time exceed $3 million per person. No one person shall, during his entire lifetime, be permitted to retain an inheritance or various inheritances in total exceeding $2 million. All incomes or estates in excess of the sums named shall be seized by the federal government for use in relief and administrative expenses. Shall I go on? I can go on. Congress shall have the sole right to issue money, and immediately upon our inauguration it shall at least double the present supply of money in order to facilitate the fluidity of credit. Did you hear any of this? Are you listening to me? Or you didn't hear this morning on the Blowhard show, so you don't know what you're listening to. Are you realizing what's going on here? Here it is. I'll read this to you from page 69, written in 1935. They realized that this country has gone so flabby that any gang daring enough and unscrupulous enough and smart enough not to seem illegal can grab hold of the entire government and have all the power and applause and salutes, all the money and palaces and will and women they want. They're only a handful. But just think how small Lenin's gang was at first, and Mussolini's, and Hitler's, and Kemal Pasha's, and Napoleon's. You'll see all the liberal preachers and modernist educators and discontented newspapermen and farm agitators, maybe they'll worry at first, but they'll get caught up in the web of propaganda like we all were in the Great War, and they'll all be convinced that even if our president maybe has got a few faults, he's on the side of the plain people and against all the tight old political machines, and they'll rouse the country for him as the great liberator. Did you hear any of this? But will Americans stand for it long, whimpered Emma? Oh, no, not people like us, the descendants of the pioneers. Oh, no? It can't happen here? Shall I repeat to you that it has happened here? Shall I repeat to you who has done this? Are you recognizing the fact that Sinclair Lewis, although he was frightened of a future government taken over by the right wing, did not even see himself as the prophet he was, and that this country would be taken over by a gang of left-wingers, the Obama gang? Are you aware of the fact that the country has been taken over by a gang, a daring gang, an audacious gang, the audacity of revolution? An audacious gang has taken over America. And there they are, ladies and gentlemen, printing money as though they own it, taxing the people who earn the money, and making deals with communists around the world under the guise of peace and freedom. Now, I want you to take the arc of what Obama has done so far and project it ahead 2 years and ask yourself, if this man is not stopped, what this country will look like, what your family will look like, and whether your freedoms will be intact unless this man is opposed at every turn. There was a British newspaper that published Obama's 10 strongest critics. They said Michael Savage is amongst them, and they quoted one thing I said. They quoted me correctly. They said the following. Michael Savage says that Obama has never heard anyone say no to him ever since his boyhood in Hawaii. As a result, he has a messianic complex, and he continues to do things that are disconnected from reality that simply aggrandize more and more power to himself. They got it right. Let's go to the callers on the Savage Nation. Chicago, Anthony, you're up. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Dr. Savage. I do not understand why the media fears you so much. Over the weekend, I listened to two radio stations where the callers were commenting on CPAC, and they actually beeped out your name.
Well, C-SPAN is run by a twerp by the name of Brian Lamb, who is a front for the Democrat establishment. Brian Lamb is an evil little man who exists only on taxpayer money. Brian Lamb runs C-SPAN, and the, let us say, left of center, anytime they had an intellectual dissident who was a giant, they simply made believe that intellectual giant who was a dissident didn't exist. They blacked that name out from the newspapers, they blacked that name out from the media, and eventually they put those names on a list, and they took those people away and put them into the Gulag Archipelago. So I'm in very good company. That a twerp like Brian Lamb would bleep my name out and you would hear it indicates just what a threat I am to them. Now, the second question, the more important, is why am I a threat to them? Isn't that the real question?
Well, we know why, because like you said before, your voice rings a truth that can't be denied. And this, the media is so terrified of you because they know that you can make such a difference. You are making such a difference.
Well, they know I stand for certain things which they oppose. I stand for firm borders, English as the national language, and the cultural bedrock that this country was built upon, borders, language, culture. They stand for the opposite. They stand for open borders. They stand for multiple languages, and they stand for no culture other than the statist culture. So I am their natural enemy. They also understand that I'm probably the, well, let's put it to you this way, amongst the most articulate in the media. They could never challenge me directly. If I had Brian Lamb on this show, I would chop him up to pieces. He wouldn't even fit back into his size 3 shoes when I got through with him.
Well, Dr. Savage, I have to say that I think...
Let me tell you something. A year ago, I was granted the Freedom of Speech Award by the talk radio industry, as you may know. And I gave a very important speech that they refused to run. And they refused to run it because I was already on their Stalinist list of none persons. That did not stop multiples of 10,000s of people from buying those copies of my Freedom of Speech Award. And I'm going to send you one right now, Anthony. Stay in the line. Stay in the line. Anthony gets a free copy of Michael Savage's DVD, his most important Freedom of Speech Award.
Mississippi James, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, I'd love to know why you seem to hang all the present problems on the Obama administration and the Democrats and liberals when I feel like both parties are equally culpable in this mess we're in, and I wish...
Well, we've heard that before. You must be a new listener, and you probably didn't hear me criticizing George Bush for 7.5 years.
Oh, no, sir. I've listened to you for years.
Well, last year I called George Bush a fiscal socialist, did I not?
You did that.
All right, so don't accuse me of being partisan in this manner. However, the magnitude of socialism has been amped up to a point of no return under Obama. How in the world can you justify $2.2 trillion in spending unless you're a gangster?
Oh, I don't, sir. It's awful.
All right. We have a gang that took over America, but they're a very clever, cunning gang. They're not acting like a gang, are they?
No, they're not.
Well, they are. They're acting like a gang, only they're pretending to be nice guys. Quote, we can go back to the dark ages. The crust of learning and good manners and tolerance is so thin. It would just take a few thousand big bombs to wipe out all the eager young men in all the libraries and historical archives and patent offices, all the laboratories and art galleries, all the castles and Periclean temples and Gothic cathedrals. All the cooperative stores and motor factories, every storehouse of learning. No inherent reason why your grandchildren, if anybody's grandchildren will survive at all, shouldn't be living in caves and heaving rocks at catamounts. Sinclair Lewis, it can't happen here. My friends, it is happening here.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Boy, do I have a special treat for you. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here's the best from my month of February. You're listening to the Savage Nation. I'm the Barber of Seville to the Barbarians on the Hill. Just give me a minute, please. Listen to this. From a dead white male. Imagine what we have now, whiny chick music and crack music, wherever you turn. Listen to the end of this. Listen to how this mind worked. It brings me to tears to think that there were minds on the planet like this. Listen to how he builds this. Listen to the mind. Okay? Just let yourself go. Go with it. Okay, here we go. We heard this, but you didn't know who it was. Higher, 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 higher. higher. But you can't stand it anymore. So, we have gone from the Barber of Seville to the Barbarians on the Hill. This is the Savage Nation talking about all of those things. You know, you listen to Rossini's Barber of Seville. I heard it the other day in a car. I said, I got to play it for a minute, take a chance. Look how fast this man's mind could be. Listen how fast it was. Pre-drug mind. And you have musicians today, so-called musicians. They're basically barbarians faking it as musicians. Everything is ersatz, the painting, the music, you name it. A collapsed, broken society with false idols everywhere you turn, whether they're false preachers or false musicians, whatever, false scientists, whatever you want to do, wherever you turn. Ersatz, you know what I'm saying? Mayonnaise, not butter, whichever way you want to look at it. Margarine, not butter, whichever way you want to look at it. Olive-like, not olive, you know. And you ask yourself, how did this happen? How did the people become so denatured and the... It's mystifying, actually, to think. It doesn't happen overnight. So if you think you're going to turn it around overnight, you're mistaken. When a thing like this happens to a society, it doesn't turn around overnight just because you know it, or because a million of us know it, or 10 million of us know it, or 30 million of us know it. You got to remember, it's a world of 5 billion people, most of whom live in the darkness of getting and spending. The darkness of getting and spending. The darkness of buying and selling. The darkness of entertaining themselves and shopping. The darkness of looking at sluts in Hollywood as the role models, not Martha Washington. The darkness of looking at fakers in Hollywood who are pretending to be heroes when the real heroes of the world are never seen nor heard, whether they be in Afghanistan or in Iraq or in a hospital room or at a ward for crippled children. You never see these people. And so we live in the darkness. That in some ways it's worse than the darkness in the Middle Ages. In some ways, although we are certainly better off physically than our ancestors were, although that's debatable unto itself, would you say that we live in the light, living in a society that we live in today? You know, you look at men in the suburbs, the white suburbs. You say, oh, that's the lily white suburbs. It's all good there. And I see men with children and wives. They're probably decent people. They dress like boys. I just look and I don't understand it. How can a grown man walk around with shorts, I ask myself, and a hat on backwards pushing a stroller? Does he look at himself in the mirror? I mean, I'm not the sartorial expert of the world, but there's something in that image that I feel as though like from another planet sometimes. A grown man pushing a carriage wearing shorts and a hat on backwards trying to look like an 11-year-old boy. How does this happen? The father looks like Beavis and Butthead. Anyway, from the Barber of Seville to the Barbarians on the Hill was the little quip. Now we're going to play the Brandenburg Concerto by Johann Sebastian Bach. And think how we've fallen from the Brandenburg Concerto to crack music and whiny chick music in department stores in just so short a period of time. And you're telling me the dead white male has nothing to teach you? I would argue to the contrary. Let's hear a little bit of the Brandenburg Concerto so you know what greatness is. Does the mind still hear this? Does the American mind still hear any? I don't know anymore. Am I allowed to come out from behind the curtain? Can I come out from behind the image? Am I allowed to show this side of myself to you, the people, the listeners, the wonderful listeners of the Savage Nation who have given me so much love, respect? Dare I play a thing like this and tell you how it breaks my heart to play it? To think that we live in a debased society where goons from the gutters are held up as role models for your children to look at. Goons from the gutters held up as musicians when they are nothing. They're not musicians. Goons from the gutters held up as artists by con men in the record companies and the movie companies. Goons from the gutters held up as role models, and you wonder why every minute they pull out a gun and shoot each other. You wonder why boys pull out a gun and shoot each other at a moment's notice because goons from the gutters are held up as role models. You're taking your son to a concert to hear the Brandenburg Concerto? Of course not. That's not a concert. A concert is a bunch of drugged, stoned out sex maniacs throwing themselves around on the ground. That's a concert today. Yeah, all right, say it's just the rantings of an old man. What do I care what you say? You know, I'm as much a hedonist as the next man. I can enjoy myself as much as you can. I can guarantee you. I know how to enjoy myself. I know how to have a drink. I know how to have a good time, believe me. But that doesn't mean I have to roll in the mud with the pigs in order to have a good time. And it means that I can tell you when the pigs are rolling in the mud of your mind, if you don't mind. That's all I'm going to say on the matter. Just play it for a minute, and I'll come back to my reality here of politics as usual on the Savage Nation. Politics as usual, the barbarians on the hill running our lives. Big Sis in charge of Homeland Security, stripping the braces off a four-year-old boy. Big Sis in charge of Homeland Security. Defense Secretary Robert Gates, saying I'm not going to go there when the word Muslim came up. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying he's worried about the consequences of an attack on Iran, not knowing which side they're playing for. You don't know which side of the what team are they playing for? You don't know it. We don't know it. There's nothing clear for us anymore. The government is confusing us by telling us that they don't know what to do. Except to control us, not the enemy. Yeah, bring in more Muslims so they can become cab drivers and deny blind people and their seeing eye dog the right to a taxi ride and then protect the Muslim cab driver, saying it's his religious right. Don't you understand what's happening to your country right in front of your eyes? Because you let liberalism, the mental disorder, take over the nation? That is why we're losing it all. It's a philosophy, Jake. It all starts with a philosophy. As so many times have I quoted Blake, the great 19th century poet who said, "The eye that alters, alters all." Don't you remember that quote? And I'm trying to say it to you because I'm not trying to prove how smart I am. Listen to what Blake was saying. The eye that alters, alters all. Once the eye is altered, meaning if you're a little nuts, everything is altered. And so we have a government now with altered eyes that have altered all. That's what he was trying to say. They may as well all be on LSD for how they're treating the people of this country. They may as well all be stoned out of their minds on some kind of drug, which is not to say they are, but they may as well be, because their altered eye is altered all. That's what we, the people, are trying to say to them. The people know more about their lives than the government does. The people know more about a balanced budget than the government does. The people know more about not taking in any more immigrants than the government does. The people know more about these things than career bureaucrats who have never created a product or a service that anybody ever wanted. Because if they did, they would be on a welfare line themselves. They would never have produced the product anybody wanted, and that's why they're in government. And so they continue to produce services nobody wants with your money. And now you wonder why people are angry? Why there's a rebellion in this country? You can call it a right-wing rebellion if you want to target the right. I don't care. Say what you want. I'm proud to say it's a rebellion on the right, but believe me, it's a rebellion from the middle. That's the one thing the New York Times didn't get right in that article, amongst others. Tea Party lights fuse for rebellion on right. It's not a rebellion on the right. It's a rebellion from the center. This is a rebellion of the middle class. This is a rebellion of Joe and Sarah. This is a rebellion of people who have worked hard all their lives, and they've lost their jobs, they've lost their houses, and they don't know why. And they see fat cats on Wall Street getting bailed out by Obama, who talks the talk but doesn't walk the walk. A man who says he's for the little people and supports the big people who put him in office. A man who says he's the taking on the banks when, in fact, it's the banks who took him and put him into the presidency. It's a man who says he's for balancing the budget when he breaks the budget. It's a man who deals with the biggest money trader on planet Earth, who could break the dollar overnight and then say, whoops, I don't know how that happened, even though I just had dinner with him, because he visited the White House 35 times, according to the White House logs. So we're not so stupid. Everyone's a winner. Anyone who makes it past Doug the screener and gets on the show with something interesting to say, we'll get a free copy of Trickle Up Poverty.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here's the best from my month of February. The show is a little bit more than just about dogs, a little personality and personal. I'm going through almost a little bit of a mental divorce from him. He's starting to get to me. I told you the problems with him. I love the guy dearly, but he's 5 years old. Now, let me put it this way. I saw a pillow when I was in Florida not too long ago. You know, pillows with slogans on them? It said, in dog years, I'd be dead. Which I laughed hysterically at myself in front of a store window. In dog years, I would be dead. It's very funny when you think about it. It used to be 7 years. Now, with the medication and the special trick foods, they go on for 20, 21 years. They cost sometimes as much as a person to keep alive towards the end. Vet bills and this bill and that bill. But we all come to take care of these animals and their surrogate children or grandchildren in so many ways. But the animal won't learn to control his peeing. I don't know how to put it. He's good for a few days. Then you wake up and he does it here, does it there in the house. Now, little dogs do this more than the big dog. I had many dogs in my life. My first was Tippy, who bit me in the foot, wrote about it in Psychological Nudity, bit me down to the bone. He was bad to the bone. He was part Chow and totally mad. He had a part purple tongue, and he was crazy. This dog went for my foot when I was 11 like it was a ham hock, and he bit it right down to the bone. I mean, it was really frightening to see your own bone sticking out. And they didn't put him to sleep. My father almost put me to sleep instead. He said, I provoked it to show you what a wonderful upbringing a person could have. But that dog wouldn't pee in the house. I think he was afraid that something would happen to him that was pretty brutal. But the truth is my father taught me how to housebreak a dog, and I did. We all did. He said, you rub the dog's nose in his pee. You do it enough times, and you say, no, don't talk to him. He's not a person. I love how liberals talk to babies. You ever see this? A whole conversation like they're going to make the child smarter. So listen, we're going to go out tonight to your favorite restaurant. What do you think you might have tonight? The kid looks at him like they're crazy. He doesn't know what you're talking about. It's the same with the dog. Use simple terms like no and yes, don't and do. So in any case, the dog, you take the nose and you rub it in real bad. I mean, right into the nostrils, in the nose, down the channel. Do that a few times. I couldn't do that to Teddy because he's too small. So the chow was bigger and tougher. Oh, he got even. Everyone rubbed his nose in it. He took it out on me. But with Teddy, I never had the heart to do that because he was like a little, you know, a little dog. He's a toy poodle. And I never cut his fur. He looks like a bear, a little teddy bear. You know, that's what a poodle looks like if you don't mutilate them the way the French do. They're gorgeous. They look like bears. They're astounding. When I walk with a dog, people say, oh, what kind of dog is that? What kind of dog is that? I say a poodle. Really? Yeah, really. He's just the way they normally are, blah, 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 blah. So anyway, I don't know what to do with him. I know that you can train him, but I'm afraid if you bring him to a trainer, they do like trick things with electric shocks that they don't show you. You know, there's something, I know they do something, you know, wrong to the dog. So I don't want to bring him over there. But I've been having discussions with him, like, Teddy, we like you. But I'm telling you, if you don't stop this, something bad's going to happen because I can't take it anymore. I just can't do this anymore. You know, you take him to one house and another. I have another house I went to. I found under the bed he did the bedspread. I'm sick of it already.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail.
If you can step over the stench of the bums and avoid the bullets in certain neighborhoods of the illegal aliens having shootouts, you'll love the city. The food is great. And that's why I live here. People say, why do you live there? Such a liberal. Not everyone's a liberal here. You know, 30% of the people feel like they're prisoners, trapped in a prison. They think that the liberals actually have that much power, but if you really understood them, they're like scarecrows, the liberals. They scream a lot. They intimidate. You know what? Don't be so afraid of them. Most of them are nothing. Do what you want to do. You live in a free country. Tell them to go to hell. That's all.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
The world is basically a stuffed pepper. You know, I have a long-running joke on The Savage Nation that you can see the world through a meatball. that when America was great in the 1950s, the meatballs were large and tasty and fluffy. And as the years went on and we became more and more socialistic, the meatballs became smaller and meaner until they were devoid of any taste, and they were very tiny like Swedish meatballs. And people have always loved that. But I'm changing the metaphor now to America is like a stuffed pepper. And that's why I'm talking about this. I'm talking about because I cooked them last night. But you want to hear something funny? I don't eat a great deal of meat. I mean, everyone, I love how they talk today like it's a moral imperative. I don't eat red meat. Oh, I haven't eaten red meat in 30 years. I said, so what? What do you want, a prize? You ever see these people walking around? I haven't touched red meat in 33 years. Great. Well, what do you want, a halo? What do I care if you ate red meat or not? They walk around like it's a religious experience, not having red meat. Now, the fact of the matter is, I've eaten very little red meat over the last 35 years, but I take enormous quantities of ascorbic acid, known to you as vitamin C, pyridoxine, known to you as vitamin B6, and vitamin E in megadoses, because the schmucks who are doing other studies proving to you that vitamin E doesn't work are using a single kind of vitamin E in a very low dose in order to prove that you only need medication such as the deadly Lipitor or Lipitor-like poisons that destroy your neuromuscular system. Anyway, to get back to what I was talking about, I like to cook. So once in a while in the winter, I eat a lot of meat. I don't know, I get a craving when it gets cold for meat, so I make the stuffed pepper. It's low-fat meat, and animals that were going to, they went to Berkeley, they have a PhD before they're slaughtered, they all have a diploma. They were raised on cappuccinos, macchiatos, with organically raised water. Anyway, the cow is in there, but I roll it in the, I chop up organic parsley, which is very important with meat. You have to spice the meat. I mean, the Greeks know what they're doing, and so do the Middle Easterners. Boy, I'll tell you, no one's better at meat than the Arabs. They know how to deal with meat. Many of you don't even understand that some of the Arabic cuisine is fantastic when it comes to meats, particularly the Persians. The Turks know how to cook meat. I'm afraid the Americans basically are a little too basic when it comes to meat. They throw the steak on a grill. It's unbelievable. Like heathens, everywhere you turn, they're just grilling meat. You know, we've gone out of the Bronze Age a while ago. But here's the weird part. I eat stuffed peppers. I drink a half a bottle of the Bordeaux wine. All right, fine. In the middle of the night, I'm dreaming that I'm eating a piece of meat that's about a foot long. It's in my hand. It's not lean steak. It's fatty. And I'm biting into it, and I can't get enough of it. What's that all about? What in the heck is the metaphor? Please don't call me as a dreaming out. Now I'm going to get somebody from Chattanooga who's a dream analyst to tell me you're dreaming, that you want to bite into the side of life. But, like, come on. You know, the fact is I'm just hungry for meat because it's cold out. I need the carnitine, and I need the iron. Most Americans don't realize that when they don't eat meat, they're actually getting an iron deficiency and a carnitine deficiency, which cannot be replaced with fish, incidentally. And I'm a lover of fish up to a point. I'm talking myself into dinner, right? I'm still sick from the lunch. That ADD lunch was so horrible. You know, when I eat a sugary lunch, I get sick for hours. It's as though I ate a candy apple. Who ever heard of Chinese food that tastes like a candy apple? 1-800-449-8255. Virginia Sam, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, please, Dr. Savage. I want to compliment you on your recipes of food. I'm a tech chef, and as a matter of fact, I'm Middle Eastern, too, and I know about cooking. Everything is just perfect, whether it's Spanish rice, you give the recipe down to the perfection, honestly, or any other thing. But the stuffed pepper, because some people, they either slice it two halves, you know, like both halves, or
No. I like to have the whole pepper hollowed out, take out the seeds, and then I put the cap back on it. I like to see it cooking with the cap on it.
That's a Middle Eastern way and Greek way, exactly.
Isn't that something? You see how I pick things up over the years? You hang around with enough Greeks, you learn how to cook. 1-800-449-8255. Pete in New York, you're on the Savage Nation from WOR.
Hey, Michael, how are you? Listen, I give you the recipe for stuffed peppers. You do the, just like you said, you saute the meat, salt and pepper to taste. You chop up some garlic. You get a sweet onion. You dice that up real small. You throw it in the meat, saute that. You dump in seasoned breadcrumbs. Then you tweak the breadcrumbs with a little Parmesan or a little locatelli.
Well, okay, but that's good if, see, I don't eat cheese. So I skip the Parmesan cheese, which is a very easy way to make flavor happen in food. There's no question about it. And I'm not a big breadcrumb personality. I mean, I used rice. I bet you don't like the rice part of it, right?
The Sicilian type of a recipe that we learned to pass down to our family.
Yeah, I'm not knocking it. I just don't eat cheese because I get swelling in my hands and feet from any kind of cheese, so I don't eat it. I used to love it. I was an Italian cheese nut. In fact, I was recently in Beverly Hills with my family over the holidays, and they went to a cheese store on Rodeo Drive, of all places, stuck in between all these high-end clothing stores. There's an amazing cheese store. I mean, they bought like 10 cheeses inside. The dogs love cheese, incidentally.
Oh, okay.
All right, I'm sorry. So do you use tomato sauce on your peppers?
You know, that's a part of whatever part of Italy you come from. You can mix a little sauce in. You could leave it full, just the way you did it. You cut it, you clean out the inside, you save the little top, you put some crushed tomatoes, some sauce in it, or not. It depends what part of it.
That's right. All right, so let's say we've stuffed it, but I use chopped Italian parsley, number one, to get flavor it. I used a lot of paprika, number two, because it's winter. I love paprika. I don't even like it most of the year. So I stuffed the meat in. I did saute it with the garlic and the onion. Actually, I used the hot olive oil, then I put the garlic and onion in first until the onion was translucent. Then I added the meat that was already rolled in the parsley. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Those are different methods, that's all. Then I stuffed the thing with pre-cooked rice that I just made a few minutes before. And then I put it into the tray, a porcelain tray in a hot oven. But I did drizzle the tomato sauce, the tomato juice I used all over it. Okay, it didn't come out the way I wanted it. Let me put it to you that way, Pete. It didn't have the bite I wanted.
Well, you were talking about in the New York Times cookbook, temperature settings. We always, I remember my mother. She used to open the thing, hey, poke it with the fork. It was done. If it wasn't, she closed the door. I never remember what
that was. Yeah, my mother, too. She always was testing. You see, that's the mark of a good cook. Today, they look at a book and a timer. It's like doctors today. They don't look at the patient. They look at a chart, and then they ask you to leave after 4.5 minutes. It's the same with fake chefs. Ersatz chefs don't even look at the food. They look at the timer. The mothers knew how to touch the food and smell the food and look at the food, right?
Yeah, and they knew if it was done or not. I don't think my mother ever, or my mother-in-law going way back, ever made a bad stuffed pepper.
All right, but wait, here's the... But what temperature did she set the oven at, Pete?
Oh, I honestly could...
See, the New York Times says 350 degrees. That's the, I would say that's the WASP way of cooking a pepper. But the real way is to make it melt down. I mean, you got to use 500 degrees for an hour if you really want to get heat in there.
Well, if she did it at 350, she just left it in the oven longer. When she used to make sauce on Sunday, marinara or filetto pomodoro, she put it in at 6 o'clock, went to charge, and we ate at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The sauce was perfect every time.
How long did your mother live?
Well, she passed away 10 years ago. She was 81, but the last few years she was in a home.
That's sad. Yeah, I lost my mother a couple of years ago at age 88. And my mother happened to have the worst diet in the history of humankind. I don't know how she did it. She violated every dietary law known to mankind. I don't know how she did it.
Yeah. I think it's part of it was genetics.
Well, I hope so. I pray to God, because my father left the earth and is in the arms of God. He left in 1970. I haven't had a father since I'm a very young man. He never met his grandchildren. You know, it's been awful having no father. But the fact is God will bless us. She went on forever. This woman loved heavy meats and this and that. But I did put her on vitamins back in 1970, you know. She was on a multi and certain other vitamins I put her on. I think that helped a lot. She also didn't drink, and she didn't smoke, to her credit.
Yeah, my mom, too. Didn't drink or smoke. My father died in 1970 also at 52. Too young.
Oh, my. So they were the same generation. Well, my dad smoked like a chimney. Philip Morris, that midget, killed him. One of your guys, Johnny Ribeiro, I think was his name. I don't know his name. Something like that. The midget?
Yeah.
Call for Philip Morris. The guy who likes showgirls and, you know, powerboats out in Sheepshead Bay. But that's neither here nor there. But it was the cigarettes, I think. What took your father?
Leukemia.
Oh, my God. Now, wait a minute. Now, you know, I'm one of these guys. I do have a degree in epidemiology. I always ask, why do you think he got leukemia when I hear a story? Because that's an outlying statistic in many families. Why do you think he got it?
I don't know. Well, he was an outpatient at the VA. He was a World War II vet. And then in the late 60s, he had some kind of blood thing going on. I don't remember all the details. I was
What did he do for a living?
He was a factory worker.
Yeah, what kind of factory?
Oh, envelope paper. Worked for a Waring Sphinx. They made paper products. Paper envelopes, a writing paper.
Well, as you know, there are very heavy industrial chemicals used in paper making. You know that.
Well, they didn't make it. They process it. After it was made, it was shipped to them.
I see. Otherwise, because I thought when I got one of the shyster lawyers listening, very excited, maybe he could start suing instead of the mesothelioma gangsters could start suing paper manufacturers next. All right, look, Pete, a lot of it is a mystery. You know that. We don't know all the answers. All we can do is keep on plugging. You know what I mean? So, Pete, before you go, a regular guy who loves the show, do you mind that I've taken a diversion from politics and WikiLeaks and SchmickyLeaks to talk about a stuffed pepper?
I love the gamut you run, the cross-section from A to Z. You cover such a multitude of topics.
What would you like me to cover politically if you had your choice and we're just sitting around having a glass of red wine? What would you like to talk about?
Oh, if we were sitting together having a glass of red wine. Oh, my goodness.
You see? No. All right. Well, think about it. I'm going to send you a copy of Trickle Up Poverty for Christmas. Christmas. C-H-R-I-S-T, not Xmas. I'll be right back. Savage. I want to talk about one other thing about food before we go back to politics or whatever. I get a lot of takeout food, lunch, dinner, because I have a lot of trouble in restaurants, except for the few that I know the owners and they give me a private room or whatever to be alone. I basically don't like to be looked at when I eat. I don't like to look at others when I eat. I'd rather watch television when I eat than do anything else. Otherwise, I feel like it's a waste of time. Unless it's a business dinner, and which I don't have because I can't eat if I'm doing business. See, I don't understand. How can a person digest food while discussing money or a deal? It's almost impossible. They're mutually exclusive. Food is supposed to be around a relaxed setting. Otherwise, you wind up with irritable bowel syndrome, or you wind up looking like an average American. So I eat a lot of takeout food. And, you know, many of us fear the Chinese government and this and that. Maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong. But what you don't know is that they've actually given all of us certain survival tools that they're not even aware of through their cuisine. Every house that I go into has a drawer filled with chopsticks that no one uses, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of packages of soy sauce, which if in an emergency you could live on, and little packages with napkins, a knife, a fork, and a spoon. Now, what could you use this for? I'm saying in an emergency. You've basically got survival food from your Chinese restaurant. Every house I go into, I don't care if it's a mansion, I don't care if it's a one-bedroom house, there's a drawer in that house if you open it. Thousands of packages of Kikkoman soy sauce, hundreds if not thousands of wooden chopsticks that people hate to use because they don't want splinters with stomach cancer, but they save them anyway, which is perfect to kindling for a fire if the electric grid should go down. So already we have heat. We can burn the chopsticks. Then we have Kikkoman soy sauce, which of course is disgusting to eat by itself, but believe me, if you had to, take a look at how good the Japanese did on Saipan with a handful of rice and soy sauce for, and then of course we got the fork, knife, and spoon and the napkin, so you can be a Boy Scout. So you see, you've got everything you need in the drawer, all provided by your takeout restaurant. And that's why I'm having fun today, because I decided at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. You get what I'm saying? What is the subject you'd like me to talk about? What they want to do to your Social Security? A group called A Third Way, which I started in, wants to cut Social Security for the top earners in the U.S. I got so roasted over this morning at 3 in the morning. I have put into this fund for 50 years, and now they want to steal the money from me? It's my money. It's not their darn money to steal from me. Well, you take a look at the names on this Third Way committee, and you're going to find out who they are and who is behind trying to steal your Social Security money if you're a high earner, take it away from you. Let us see who's on it. Alex Rivlin, a member of Obama's debt commission. Bill Galston, a former Democratic domestic policy advisor to President Bill Clinton. So the Third Way is a group of evil men, including, evil in my opinion, John L. Vogelstein, former president of private equity firm Warburg Pincus LLC. Just the names Warburg and Pincus should tell you that they're up to no good. And the vice chairman is David Heller, global co-leader of, there we are again, Goldman Sachs Group Inc.'s securities division. Among the 12 Democratic members of Congress who are listed as honorary co-chairmen who want to steal my Social Security are Rep. Jane Harman of California, the richest woman in Congress the last I checked, and Senator Evan Baugh, no one knows how to pronounce his name, Baugh of Indiana. So what they want to do is steal my Social Security. Now, I want to remind you, I put money into that fund all my life, that I've done well in the late years of my life because I'm still working, because I choose to. They have the right to steal my money. What if I want to turn my Social Security over to one of my children? The government has a right to steal it from me? I don't think so. Now, who is it who's going to get hit? First of all, you're going to get hit because the Social Security, this is so boring, but it bothered me at 3 in the morning. Right now, I could care less because I'm queasy from the Chinese food. The retirement age now scheduled to rise to 67 in 2027. You hear? You think you'll still be here? Would gradually increase to age 68 by 2041. I'll stick around and let you know how that is. To age 69 by 2059 and to age 70 by 2077. Good luck. Good luck, because we've always known the Social Security plan made Ponzi look like an honest man. Mr. Ponzi makes the U.S. government look like a life. Mr. Ponzi, by comparison to what the Social Security scheme is, et cetera, you can figure it out. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer of Maryland said in June that Congress should consider raising the retirement age and providing lower Social Security and Medicare benefits to wealthier beneficiaries. I say, screw you, Steny. How's that? It's my money, Steny, not yours. You're a crook if you think you're going to take it from me without a fight. Okay? I resent this. I don't care how much I earn. I don't care how much I make. Who the hell is the government to steal something I put into all my life? With virtually no interest, by the way. You don't care about this. I knew it would be a dead topic. I knew it. But I feel it's information you should know what the Democrats are up to. They're all Democrats. They're all socialists. And they're all out to steal your Social Security. They're called Third Way. Why don't they just call them Lenin Way? Lenin Way. It's like Carlito's Way. You know what I mean? It's not the Third Way group. It's like Carlito's Way. You know, all he needs is lizard skin boots, Steny Hoyer, and a sombrero. What do you think? Because the way they dress tells you who they are? I have more faith in a gangster than I do in these congressmen lately. At least you know where you stand with a gangster. Generally, you do. Well, you generally know where you stand with a gangster. Let's see what's next on the Savage Nation. Las Vegas, Elaine, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. It's nice to meet with you today. I can't believe I actually got through. I usually never can. I didn't want to discuss any of the insanity that's going on in the nation and the world. I just simply wanted to tell you how much I appreciate your honesty, your passion, and your integrity. I got your new book checked out from my local library, but I had to take it back because there's such a long waiting list, so that's a good thing, isn't it?
Well, I'm going to send you a free copy, Elaine, for calling this in. I thank you very much. Yeah, it was sold out of my local Barnes & Noble. I went in over on the day after Thanksgiving when it's supposed to be Black Friday. It was a Black Friday for me. There were no books. So the manager said, well, that's a good thing and a bad thing. I said, well, yeah, it's good that it was sold out. It's kind of bad that it's not here on the day everyone's looking to buy. So I said, I'm a glass half empty kind of guy. So she's a nice lady. She's a black lady. She laughed. She says, Michael, she says, you're a glass half empty kind of guy? She said, I think you're a glass half full kind of guy. I said, well, okay, whatever you think is okay.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Merry Christmas, Savage Nation. And here is a gift for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here's the best from my month of February.
You know, it's interesting that dogs work. They're working dogs. You watch a show on nature. Like I love nature shows. Science Channel, they showed 6,000 feet below the sea creatures that I never knew existed. Every one of the creatures below the sea has adapted over the eons to some form of capacity to hunt for its food, to hide from the predators that want to eat it. Every single creature in the ocean is either prey or predator to one species or another of another kind of sea organism. And the point of the story is that every animal on Earth works to both protect itself and find its own food, except man. Man may be the only animal on Earth that relies upon others to feed it and gives others nothing in return. And that's why we are resentful of a government that seems to be more concerned about the freeloaders than about those of us who provide the income for the freeloaders. You think this is all hot air and rhetoric? You are mistaken, my friend. Do you know that over 60% of Americans receive more benefits than they pay in taxes? That means 40% of us support 60% more of us. That means that it's an insupportable structure. Did you hear what I just said? Why on earth should we support able-bodied people? Why should we educate and provide medical care for illegal aliens and their children? Why should prisoners be given such glorious treatment in prisons where it costs $50, $60, or more thousand dollars a year to give them everything under the sun? Special religious meals and books. I didn't say turn it into a devil's island, but I would say something is wrong with a country that is so led by the liberal left that we are bled until there's nothing left in us to give. And I learned from nature. I'm still working at my age. I could have retired a couple of years ago. There were times I couldn't have, but there are times that I could. Why do I keep working? At this point, it's in my blood. It's in my blood. That's all there is to it. I was raised to work. I was thinking about this the other night to tell you this on the radio. What do you mean I was raised to work? Someone beat me with a hose? No. What do you mean I was raised to work? I'll tell you exactly how, in case you want to know how to raise your children. I thought about it the other day. As I get older, I start thinking back on my childhood a lot. My mother and father, if they were to talk about someone in the neighborhood, in the building, and we grew up in the Bronx, they would say, oh, he's a hard worker. They would say it with almost a whisper looking up to him. Didn't matter what he did. They said, Joe is a painter, but he's a hardworking man. In other words, they said it with respect, the way they said it. So I learned that they respected people who worked hard. That was an important thing in my development, I realized looking back. In other words, they weren't doing it for me. They didn't say, oh, let's show young Michael how to grow up and who to become. They respected people who worked hard. And they had no respect. They had just contempt for leeches. I don't think they knew any. There was not a person in the building who didn't work hard. Everybody worked. Everybody raised the family. The children were clean. They were all well fed. They were all poor, but nobody knew they were poor. The apartments were clean. And long after we were left the neighborhood, another generation moved in from a different country of origin. And they were a little different. They burnt they were on welfare. And they burnt their mattresses and threw them out of the window into the streets if they didn't get fed. You know, sort of like you'd see at a zoo on a Monday. And you wonder why there's anger in this country? How did this happen? How did a whole nation of hardworking people get taken over by a nation of leeches? And a government that caters to the leeches, not the people who give them the money to give to the leeches. How does this happen? It's unnatural. It's insane. So you want to know what the Tea Party movement is about? You want to know what conservative talk radio has been about? You want to know what my best-selling books have been about? You want to know what the town hall meetings have been about? You want to know why the politicians and the reporters look like deer, you know, in the so-called searchlight? Because they saw real people really angry with real knowledge of what the hell is going on. They know that they've been had and they don't want it anymore. They're not going to take it. There is a revolution brewing in the country. San Francisco, Michael Michael, what's on your mind?
Michael, you said you're speaking out of both sides of your mind. That is a sentence that only the great Michael Savage could enunciate.
Well, what I really wanted to say to that caller was you're speaking out of both sides of your hind, but it was a family show, so I couldn't do it.
Michael, I'm familiar with a book called The Road to Serfdom. I'm sure you know it.
Yes.
Peter Kayak. if I had to think of a document that would represent your show, the closest thing I could find, where is Michael Savage coming from? I think it's that book. Am I out of town?
No, you're not out of town. I'm an anti-communist. I've been an anti-communist all of my life because I see the devastation it has wrought around the world. I'm an anti-socialist because I know socialism is run by bureaucrats. I hate bureaucrats. Every interchange with a bureaucrat makes me want to smash my head through a plate glass window. Most bureaucrats are evil, mean, small-minded Lilliputians, whether it's a small zoning permit or something large. A bureaucrat is a bad person. They're not good people. I want the government out of my life. I want individual freedom, and I want less government, not more government. So therefore, this is all wrong from Obama. He is a socialist slash Marxist slash Leninist, depending upon the issue, depending upon the particular issue. He's either a socialist, a Marxist, or a Leninist. He's absolutely against capitalism. He's against business. He's against individual freedom. There's nothing about this man that is American.
Yes! Ah, oh, that felt really good. That was nice.
How does that feel? Try that one on for size. Does that fit?
I'm telling you, that's how you run with it. Right there. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, Michael, you got it. That's why the show is so good. Because I know who he is. What do you want me to do? I know it in my bones. I know what this gang is all about. But here we are. Got excited. Found a Sauvignon Blanc I could drink. Lorenzo makes one. I didn't get a headache. I mean, that to me is a miracle. I can drink wine again. I feel liberated. I said, Lorenzo, do you use malolactic fermentation? No, I don't use no malolactic fermentation. I said, good. Thank God. No headache-o. No malolactic-o, no headache-o. That's all I know. Because I gave up on the New Zealand wines. They became too fruity. I don't know. It was with the lemon-lime. I felt like I was drinking 7-Up. Years ago, when I used to drink wine, I'm slipping into the food now. Okay, I do it. I can't find a good white wine anymore. 20 years ago, I used to drink, if I was lucky, I went to someone's house, they had a Grand Cru Chablis. We drank a lot of French Chablis when it was really good. Then there was the Grand Cru Chablis, which a professor friend had. I never heard anything like it. Then there was Batard Chasson. It was unbelievable, white wines then. Then all of a sudden, something happened with the white wine. They became, I don't know what they did to them, creamy, fruity. Sorry to tell you, a lot of the children who grew up drinking soda started drinking wine. They didn't like the actual taste of wine. They wanted a soda with alcohol. So it's hard to find, you know. There's no such thing. And New Zealand used to make a great, when it was the Marlboro New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, it was a different story with a slight tinge of the limey in it, you know. Even though the limey's made it, it was a slight tinge of limey. Then all of a sudden now it's like soda. It's like a lemon limey. It's like drinking on a machine in a It's like going for lemon limey in a Lois Pitkin.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here's the best from my month of February. We've all heard about the wonderful Tea Party movements around America, and there's no question they have changed the political landscape of America, and by the way, bless them for that. But I want you to watch what's going on. I want you to watch how the Tea Party movement is slowly being gobbled up and co-opted by the Republican Party. Here's a headline, Tea Party Patriots Launch Contract from America. Now, there's a conservative political action conference going on as we speak. At this conference, we read that the Tea Party Patriots have launched their contract from America in order to make Washington more accountable. And the chairman of it is none other than former Republican Dick Armey. If I remember correctly, Dick Armey attacked talk radio a few years ago. On the list is Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform, a man very friendly with the Saudi Arabians. And there are other groups, and I'm concerned for one reason. They're listing their plans for a document to be unveiled on April 15th on their contract from America. And right now I'm going to read you their 22 proposed solutions. Some of them, stop the tax hikes, commit to government transparency, protect the Constitution, pass real health care reform, and runaway government spending. Protect internet freedom, pass an all-of-the-above energy policy, give parents more choices in the education of their children, demand a balanced budget, protect freedom of the press, protect private property rights, reject cap and trade, no czar regulation without representation, no more bailouts, audit the Fed, stop the pork, enact fundamental tax reform, stop career politicians, restore fiscal responsibility. Now, every one of those is a good statement and a good thing for the government to do. But I studied it, and something stood out in bold caps to me. There's not one mention of illegal immigrants. There's not one mention of borders. There's not one mention of language, meaning English only. There's not one mention of voter ballot reform to make sure that the illegal aliens don't vote. And moreover, there's no mention of anything to do with our culture. There's not one mention of prayer. There's not one mention of abortion. There's not one mention of the cultural war that is going on in America. So I smell a rat. I see the Republican Party taking over the Tea Party movement, and I see them crafting proposed solutions to the problems that we are having today simply to get themselves reelected without alienating the huge block of A, fill in the blank, people opposed to Christians, B, people opposed to freedom of people opposed to those who protest abortion. They also want to appease illegal aliens. They want to appease La Raza. They want to appease virtually every group in America and pretend that they are the real patriots. I don't buy it. I'm Michael Savage. I'm an independent. And I will continue to call them like I see them. I may be the first one to tell you this, but I won't be the last. Watch out. All movements in this country are generally co-opted. The Tea Party movement is no different. Right now it's being co-opted from within. Watch out for Dick Armey, in my opinion. Watch out for Grover Norquist, in my opinion. Watch out for some of these groups who put the word tea and party in their names, but in fact are just front groups for other interests. I want to thank my producer, Doug Lynn, and I want to thank my new associate producer. You know, normal people do this. I should have done this over the years. I don't do it. Now let's go to a boy from Brooklyn, Bernie Sanders, who makes me sound like I speak the King's English. Bernie Sanders is a communist. He's an avowed socialist, rather, in Vermont. Bernie Sanders found slim pickings in Brooklyn because people saw men like him for years. They knew about this kind of left-wing radical lunatic going all the way back to the ILGWU and the soapboxes in Union Square. They threw him out of Brooklyn. So Bernie Sanders goes to Vermont, and he hoodwinks the poor farmers in Vermont into thinking he'd be a good senator. And here he is comparing climate change deniers to Holocaust deniers. I swear to God. Here is Bernie Sanders in clip 5.
The reason that this debate is so important is that it reminds me in some ways of the debate taking place in this country and around the world in the late 1930s. And during that period, with Nazism and fascism growing, a real danger to the United States and democratic countries all over the world, there were people in this Congress, in the British Parliament, saying, don't worry, Hitler is not real.
Now listen to where he goes with this. I want to show you the deranged mind of the socialist. Listen.
Global warming is real. If we do not get our act together, there will
stop.
Be devastating.
Let's stop for a minute. Global warming is real to schmucks like you who have no training in science. Global warming is real to schmucks like Bernie Sanders, whose brains were destroyed by too much seltzer. The carbon dioxide in the seltzer apparently was toxic to their thinking. Global warming is real to only fraud artists like you and Al Gore. Global warming has now been shown to be a fraud across the Western landscape, except apparently in the United States of America. Now he then says, if we do not get our act together, another 60s phrase. Listen to this communist guy. Listen to clip 6 now.
Global warming is real. If we do not get our act together, there will be devastating impacts for our kids and our grandchildren, causing, among other things, trillions of dollars in order to repair that damage, if it is repairable at all. And the longer we delay, the longer we have this senseless debate, the less prepared we will be.
The longer we have this senseless debate? You stupid schmuck. Haven't you seen any of the ClimateGate emails that were exposed that it's all fraud? You stupid schmuck. You should be forced to step down from Congress. How could you be a senator, Bernie Sanders? I demand you appear on the Savage Nation and debate global warming with me. You stupid schmuck, you.
It's unbelievable to me. This is a U.S. senator. A putz like this, a moron like this gets up there and says the longer we debate, the less prepared we will be. You know, the essence of science is debate. The essence of science is to present the facts and analyze the facts dispassionately. And how now you have a hack, a low-life hack from the gutters of Brooklyn in the Senate from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, avowed socialist, calls himself an independent, saying that anyone who debates this is like a Holocaust denier. First of all, any Jewish group listening to this should force Bernie Sanders to step down, or at least issue an apology, for comparing a legitimate scientific debate to Holocaust denial. Bernie Sanders, you are a fraud, and you have just insulted all of the victims of the Holocaust, in my opinion. You're an insult to all Jews on the planet for comparing a legitimate scientific debate to denying the Holocaust, which we know existed. Bernie Sanders, you should be forced to apologize or be forced to quit the Senate. You are a sham and a fraud, in my opinion. And I will debate you on the Savage Nation if you don't like what I'm saying about you. I challenge you to come on my show. I challenge you to come on this program, Bernie Sanders. Michael Savage, PhD, University of California at Berkeley, challenges you schmuck, to debate the reality of global warming. And you know you won't do it, Bernie, because you know that you don't have anything on your side but rhetoric and hot air. You know that, Bernie.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Last summer, I wrote Psychological Nudity, which were all of my radio stories, One Arm Frank, etc. I'm going to take requests of which story you would like me to read to you of the Michael Savage radio story list, the playlist. Is it My Silent Brother, The Electric Blue Saddle Stitch Pants, Fat Al's Tuna, Nutty Friend, That Crazy Mother, Coney Island Wax Figures, Dead Man's Pants, Tippy the Mad Dog, Woodchuck Bill, Happy and Sad Cufflinks, When Pasta Was Spaghetti? Was it First Autopsy? Was it Talking to a Bum About God? Was it Working on Cruise Lines? Was it Love by the Sewer Plant? Was it From Immigrant Son to Radio Stardom? Or any of the other favorites? Because they're all in Psychological Nudity, and I'd rather read them to you for a little bit before we get back to politics. I'll read one. Here's one. I like Walter Cronkite and Purgatory of Manhood by Cyanide. So here's what I wrote. Who did I actually like in mainstream news? Let me just run on this for a minute. I did like Walter Cronkite because he had a deep voice and a mustache. He reminded me of an Italian dentist that I knew in the Bronx. You always had to behave yourself when you were around guys with mustaches like that because they could do weird things to you if you didn't. Cronkite was a very authoritative man, and how he presented the world is how I thought the world was. I might be eating steak and French fries and cherry vanilla ice cream on a TV tray, building up my negative cardiac profile while Dad was working. I'd be watching Cronkite. I had no idea what he was talking about. You see, kids don't really know what the news is, nor does the average adult really pay that much attention. I think we give media people too much power by thinking people really listen to their every word. Every time they put out another fib, I became incensed. Oh, look what they said. Look at the phony poll about Obama. But the fact is that they don't have that much direct influence on the average person. I get excited because I can see what they're doing, but do you? Dad would walk in at 6:30 at night, white from a day in the store. He might just have fought his way home through a snowstorm in his big green DeSoto. And here is his number one son getting fat, watching television, eating steak and cherry vanilla ice cream. He's starving and there's no food for him. I don't have to tell you what flashed through his eyes, my eyes, my mother's eyes, and the dog's eyes. He never thought I'd amount to anything. The arguments we would have, my God. You're ruining the kid. Look what you're doing. You're making him soft. You've got to make a kid hard, he used to yell. Look what you're doing to the kid. You're making him a weakling. He'll never amount to anything. He's soft. Look at him. Over there eating that steak and ice cream. He was probably starving at that point. He got home with the slush and galoshes, snow over the top, and his worst nightmare came true. His wife was catering to his son. Then I go on. The guy comes back from the hunt, and what's going on in the cave? The woman he is married to is cooking for the child who has done nothing that day but go to school and look at girls.
So it was soon thereafter that the whole soft life came to an end. No more ice cream, no steak, no TV trays. I was forced to go into his store's basement on Ludlow Street to clean bronzes. That's the beginning of my purgatory and my manhood. You know, this is very good writing. I was too close to it last year to realize how good this is. This is as good as the... You see why I like The Sopranos and Mad Men? I have a flavor. I'm editorializing now. I'm reading my own book like new. It's good writing because it's simple, basic. I grew up reading real writers like Hemingway, who wrote... See, he was a journalist first, and he taught me to write as succinctly as possible. Then, when I was studying to be a scientist, I learned scientific writing to write scientific papers, and the first rule was succinct, as few words as possible to get your ideas across. Anyone can write long sentences, and the hair for, that to for, and then... That's not the way to write. So I said, that's the beginning of my purgatory, my manhood. It says it like straight out, you know? I was cast down into the cellar where I used cyanide solution to clean bronze statues of their gorgeous patina. The statues were gorgeous. I learned a lot about art because I stared at them all day long. Now you may say, what do you know about art? Well, I know quality from junk, artistry from fakery. The rest is a matter of taste. Now, let's analyze that line together. Look what I just wrote. What do you know about art? I know quality from junk, artistry from fakery, the rest is a matter of taste. That sentence is succinct, and it says it all. Anyway, so I'll go back to the book. So these figures would come in with a brown or black patina, which is the result of oxidation over time. The patina was sublime, but the nouveau who were buying the figures to turn them into lamps wanted them to glitter like gold. Underneath the patina was the original bronze metal. I'll take that, I'll turn it into a lamp, mount the thing, blah, blah, blah. They'd buy it, and a certain number would be left for the weekend that I'd have to clean down in the basement, down into the dirty, horrible, dank dungeon, filled with huge old wine barrels, a toilet from hell, no mirror on the wall except the shattered shards speckled from the acid that hit it. I'm down there from a young age with a toothbrush, scrubbing away at the patina. I don't really know if the cyanide was that bad. If it was, I'd be dead by now, I think. Perhaps it protected me from something. Hey, Dad, explain to me how I can use cyanide, since I understand from basic chemistry that they use cyanide balls at San Quentin. They put a guy in the chair and strap his head over the bucket and the pellets drop in. Then the gas comes up and he's dead in a few seconds. Dad, why would you put me in a basement with cyanide pellets to clean bronzes? Here's the answer now. This is right out of the Bible. I couldn't believe it. Took me 30 years to figure this out. This was a repetition of Abraham and Isaac. You see, Abraham picked up the knife and God said, slay your son. He didn't even ask, my son? You sure you mean my son? Your son, I want him dead. All right, I'm a good guy, I'll kill my son for you. He grabs the kid, grabs him by the neck, like an Islamo-fascist, and is about to cut his throat when God says, wait, I was just kidding, I was only testing you. Now, no one ever talked about what that did to Isaac. The father he trusted suddenly grabs him by the neck and wants to cut his throat. You know, all you hear about is Abraham was so loyal and listened to God. But what did it do to Isaac? It drove him nuts. He never trusted anyone after that. His own father wanted to cut his throat because he was listening to someone in the sky. So now I'm in the basement, and he says to me, you're going to clean bronzes because you're going to become a man. I'm going to make you tough. You got to do something, blah, blah, blah. And you're going to use these pellets. Here's a big barrel of them. I get them from a chemical supply store. You drop them in water, and then you dip in your brush and wash the bronze, and the black comes off, and it looks shiny again. The customer wants the shiny statue for a lamp. So I say to him, how do you know it's not going to kill me? Here's what Abraham says to me. I mean, in the modern day story, he says, because there's a potassium salt of the cyanide and a sodium salt of the cyanide. But here's the kicker. Dad doesn't tell me which one kills and which one dissolves patina, which is exactly why I went into science and medicine and chemistry to find out whether he was trying to knock me off or not. I'm sorry. This is good writing. I'm sorry. This is good. Nobody else would do this except Louis from the Bowery, the one with the monkey. We get rubber gloves on up to our elbows and drop these white pellets into water, then turn it into a cyanide solution. Then we take the brush and rub the figure until the patina came off the bronze. I'm rubbing. It would take you an hour or two to do each statue. Rub, rub. I'm a kid. I'm rubbing. And what I'm thinking about is where I'm going that night. I'm going out on a date or to hang out with my friends or I'm going to a movie. Meanwhile, my face would be getting blotched, and I'm rubbing and cleaning in what's like a Dickens basement. So I get into high school chemistry years later, and I told my teacher what I was doing. I was using cyanide balls. My father had a huge chemical supply. It was not used for anything but this. I said to the teacher that I use these cyanide balls for cleaning statues, for cleaning solution. Teacher said, what? It's poisonous, but don't get worried. There's a sodium cyanide, and there's a potassium cyanide salt. Now, to this day, I don't know which one kills you. If you're a doctor reading this or listening to this on the Savage Nation or a trained scientist, I want you to think about what I'm going to say. Is it possible that inhaling the fumes that didn't kill you outright in some way mitigated against the oxidation of fatty foods powering through my arteries? I have a pet theory that in some way, although it blotched my face, it built up my immunity to something. I know it did. I just don't know what. So that story is found in Psychological Nudity by Michael Savage. Great story. Worthy of a movie. I'm actually trying to collect radio memorabilia for a radio museum I'm creating. I don't know where I'm going to put the museum, but I'm going to create a radio museum. And I want to have the cups from all of the affiliates I'm on. And I want to have the, I don't know, just station banners. I like radio memorabilia. It's my field. I like microphones with radio. Like if I can get old microphones from the radio station sent to me, they'll go in there with their little, you know, flag on it. It's like when I was a teacher once, I got old microscopes that they were throwing out made of brass. They replaced it with plastic. They thought they were worthless. I didn't sell them. I have like a couple of them. So I grew up on radio. It's interesting. I'm one of the few people in radio who grew up on radio. And one of the things I grew up on was a thing called Inner Sanctum Mysteries. This is from Radio Mysteries from yesteryear. I grew up on this. I used to thrill and chill to these kinds of things in my father's lap. He'd be smoking the Philip Morris, sitting on a couch, newspaper kind of on his lap, after dinner, and I'd be listening to Inner Sanctum with him. And he would say to me, you know, radio is better than TV. I said, why is that? He said, because you have to use your imagination to listen to this story. You have to think. He said, television is a completely different story. I said, what do you mean, Dad? He said, because they're telling you the story with images. There's nothing for you to imagine. Radio is all a theater of the mind, he said to me. I wonder if it matters if you grew up in radio as to how you perform in radio. I really wonder. You know, I don't know. I'm not trying to make myself better than anybody. I'm just saying I do enough of that, God knows. But I'm just wondering if you grew up in radio, if it affects how you actually perform in radio. Whatever. I know that if you grew up, let's say, in the country club set, and you went to Yale, and your father was a president or a senator, and you were in one of those clubs, and you wind up as a treasury secretary, senator, or president, you have no way to understand what the average person thinks, feels, or does. You look down upon them like bugs. Anyway, so I grew up on the Inner Sanctum. It was an old radio mystery theater, and it was very, very mysterious, featuring like it was a mystery show. The lights would go dim in the living room, and I'd lie there and inhale the secondhand smoke of the Philip Morris, and here's what I heard.
Inner Sanctum Mysteries. Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum. This is Raymond, your host at the squeaking door. Come in, won't you?
Well, anyway, that was the way. It was a little slow for today, you know, with the speed that we transmit ideas, but it was amazing when you're a child to listen to that kind of stuff. And, of course, you know, wouldn't work today. But one last footnote. I remember when I was a little older, I don't know, 10, 11, my mom, God rest her soul, took us to Radio City Music Hall, the NBC building. And we went into a radio sound studio. You know, they used to invite the public in. It was so thrilling for me to go into that radio studio, and they entertained the average person by showing them how sound effects were made in radio. And when the guy came out with like a sheet of metal, and he said, "Here is how we make thunder," and he rolled, you know, he moved the sheet of metal in his hand, and I heard thunder. And here's how we show horses galloping, and he took the two like cups, and he did them on a sound like a wooden hollow wooden sound board, and he made the sound of horses of galloping. I was amazed. I was just amazed that you could make sound effects in a radio studio sound like an animal or thunder or lightning, and it wasn't actually there. Then Mom would take my friend and I over to a chain restaurant called the Floridian. They had like the Floridian, the New York, and the Californian, and they made eggs like a certain way. They mixed it where it came out in like a funnel, like a silo. What a beautiful thing that was. But today, no, the kids are not into that. Today they're home looking at internet pornography in their bedroom getting the exercise that teenage boys have been getting since the beginning of time. Play the Lone Ranger.
Are you still there?
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver. The Lone Ranger.
Oh, I love that. See, I'm still looking for the Lone Ranger to come along and save America. Let me hear that again. I want to hear the Lone Ranger.
Hi-Yo Silver!
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver. The Lone Ranger.
Oh, yeah, the Green Hornet also. Let me hear the Green Hornet. I'll listen.
He hunts the biggest of all game. Public enemies who try to destroy our America.
Yeah, I'm the Green Hornet. So of all of these characters, the Inner Sanctum story, no. The Lone Ranger, not me. I'm not the Lone Ranger because I'm not out to save anybody. But the Inner this one's good. The Green Hornet is like a bit of my show's a little bit of the Green Hornet, isn't it? Play the Green Hornet again.
He hunts the biggest of all game. Public enemies who try to destroy our America.
Yeah, good luck. Yeah, right. Try to destroy our America. Hello. Hello. Yeah. All right, got it with the bumblebee already. I don't want to hear any more. Savage. Since I've had my espresso, and since I'm not going to sleep tonight anyway because I'm sacrificing tonight's sleep for today's show, as I did last night. I've been up, I think, for about 36 hours. No, I slept, but I didn't sleep. It was like a tossed, horrible, you know, the nightmares were daymares in the middle of the night. But there was nowhere to go in there. The problem is I have nothing to do in the middle of the night. What do you do in the middle of the night when you can't sleep? I have answers to that, too, because there was a period in my life that I was totally insomniac, and I thought I would die from a lack of sleep, and then I read a lot of books on insomnia, and I found out that insomnia can be your best friend. What it means is you don't really need to sleep. You're not tired. Most of us sleep when we don't even have to, incidentally. This is a myth that you have to sleep. It's like a myth like you have to have three meals a day, or that you have to drink 8 glasses of water or three cups of milk a day or whatever. You're not tired, so you're not sleeping. The trick is to not lay in bed. I remember reading one book during this period when I couldn't sleep, and it was mainly money worries. It was money worries because of a lot of reasons, whatever. The kids were young, and I was worried about their future and my future, and what am I going to do? And I killed myself, and they won't hire me because I'm a white male, and they're hiring idiots and morons and putting them into jobs they're not qualified for, and perverts, which, of course, was 100% true. Just take a look at your universities today, putting what they're doing in the universities outside the science departments, which, of course, unfortunately for them, they can't yet populate with their plants, because either you understand the periodic table of the elements or you don't. You can't quite do what you do in the social sciences. Nevertheless, I'm up, I'm this and that. So I get a book that says more people have died worrying about a lack of sleep than from a lack of sleep, and I forget who wrote the book. And it was like 10 things you could do. Someone's going to write this down, steal it, and make a book out of it probably. That's okay. I don't really care. Go ahead and do it. And I learned a lot of different techniques. The number one thing was I went out on my deck and looked at the stars. And that's when I started to love stars again after childhood. You see, okay, I'm up. It's dark. The sky is black. The stars are bright. What am I going to do with the time? How about getting out a book that shows me star formations? So there they were. And slowly, you know, and the next one is learn to read, learn to do this, learn to do that. And before long, when you stop worrying about not sleeping, you wind up sleeping again. It's like everything else. You understand that or not? Sure, it's like everything else. You know, there used to be an adage amongst guys that a lot of guys are always hungry for a date for a woman and they couldn't get one. And the guys who did always had the same story to tell, which is that women can tell when you're nervous and you want a woman and they'll avoid you like you have leprosy. That the only guys women want are the ones who don't want them or let's say are aloof and really don't care. It's a terrible reality. It's the same the other way, too, by the way. You know, you get desperate, the other party can sense it like an animal. Well, how was it put? We pursue that which retreats. Have you heard that one in the dating world? It's pretty much true in the business world as well. We pursue that which retreats. So the best thing to do is retreat, even when you want to pursue, in most cases. It's a terrible rule, but it's like hunting, and you ask a hunter. There's only one way to hunt, or there's only a particular few ways to hunt. And none of them consist of rushing right at the animals. But that's neither here nor there. So let's go back to the insomnia before I get too far off the track. There are many other things you can do. And, of course, I learned to use passion flower herbal tea. I was very into the whole story there. And that's a great – wait, hold it. There's my story. Let me tell you how I learned to use passion flower herbal tea and how not only did it give me relief from insomnia, but I then learned to carry this tea around with me all over the world in my travels. And it became a great relaxant on airplanes. I didn't have to drink any alcohol. I didn't need the two little bottles of wine that they used to have in those days. Remember those days they served you wine in those two little bottles that you got? The El Cheapo wine bottles that were on airplanes? Now it's bottled wine. Well, anyway, so I heard about a guy, a pharmacist in San Francisco on Ellis Street. He was like an old guy, about 85, 88 at the time. Do you have a passion flower herbal tea? He says to me, why, who are you? What do you want? It was like right out of Brooklyn, and the guy, it was in San Francisco. I said, no, I just, he said, what, are you an inspector with the FDA? I have nothing. Get out of my store.